Hi, Greg Perry, the Historic Preservationist. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 63. Continuing with our early American architecture, we're going to title this one, Inheritance and Adaptation. So the study of early American architecture has often been framed within the border of context of colonial American history, a story that is shaped by the push and pull of two forces, European inheritance on one hand and the adaptation to local environments and developing social and economic conditions on the other. Some things worked in the New World, others did not. Colonists experimented with the traditional British building practices and over time retained those elements that best suited their immediate circumstances. As the recent excavations inside the fort at Jamestown proved, they charted a separate course from mainstream English building practices from the beginning of settlement in the first decades of the 17th century. In a period when local customs and traditions were a vibrant force in shaping daily life in England, the formation of communities in the Chesapeake, which suddenly brought together people from various backgrounds and places, ruptured many old patterns. Unavoidably, much of the particular richness of their old provincial backgrounds was lost, but contact with other settlers provided a catalyst for forging a new regional culture, climate, and a 3,000-mile-long supply chain certainly worked against the simple relocation of the English ways, no matter what their regional origins may be. Builders had a plentiful supply of wood, but manufactured materials such as nails, paint, hardware, and glass, which were quite costly. An unhealthy climate where the mortality rate was appalling, even by the 17th century standards, disrupted the formation of familiar patterns of domestic life in this rough and tumble frontier-type culture. These factors fostered the growth of building practices based mainly on impertinent construction techniques. In contrast, the settlement of New England occurred in a more orderly fashion, causing fewer impediments to the replication of traditional patterns of English life. Extended families and members of entire communities in East Anglia, for example, immigrated together and were able to reestablish something of a social structure of their old world habitations much more readily than stony New England. As the Fairbanks Howe suggests, carpenters in the northern colonies almost immediately took up the construction of timber frame dwellings in a manner they had known in East Anglia. Yet even in New England, the allure of unlimited timber supplies began to change the way some craftsmen fashioned their homes. But by the second half of the 17th century, sawmills produced thousands upon thousands of board feet of lumber for sheathing walls and roofs, eliminating the use of smaller intermediate studs and, in some cases, or promoting the use of multiple common purlins rather than common rafters in others. Yet New England colonists never experimented outside the structural box frame. Wedded to the use, for example, of the blind dovetail wall plate and the tie beam assembly, one of the telltale signs of English timber framing, according to Richard Harris. Building tradesmen who came ashore in the Chesapeake had no such familiar housing market awaiting their skills. In contrast to New England, the southern colonies were a mixing bowl well supplied with young men looking for adventure, or a way out of dismal prospects in London and other major cities and villages. If they survived the year of seasoning, most found back-breaking labor in the tobacco fields and a place to sleep in dwellings that must have resembled communal bunkhouses. The sound of gnawing termites eating away at the very foundation of their houses must have disturbed the golden dreams of so many New World adventures. Although a handful of 17th century buildings resembled in plain construction and the scale of the houses of minor gentry and prosperous farmers in some parts of England, Most farmhouses erected by this dispersed agricultural society varied significantly from the standard English patterns. By the middle of the century, immigrants to the southern colonies acknowledged the difference between well-framed English houses with stout posts, beams, and braces, fastened with mortise and tenon and dovetail joints, and a cheaper and far more prevalent form of riband-clapboard carpentry. The lower part of this hewn and riven frame was composed of posts and studs that sat 2 or 3 feet from the ground. The ghosts of these framing members were what archaeologists stumble upon at almost every 17th century site they excavate. A covering of 4 or 5 foot long riven clapboard boards provided structural rigidity for the wall, roof, and frames. This relatively light and simplified structural system eliminated much of the labor-intensive and complicated joinery of traditional English framing. Colonists rarely considered these buildings, which they refer to tellingly as Virginia houses, as anything more than inferior but necessary structures. The building practice suited the impertinent nature of a plantation society. Along with the adoption of earth-fast construction methods that stood outside the mainstream of traditional English building practices, colonists restructured the manner in which they lived, worked, and even entertained. For much of the 17th century, they experimented with many contemporary English house types, juggling elements to fit the needs of a plantation culture increasingly dependent upon servant and slave labor. Through passage and lobby entrance houses were among the most and various familiar forms that they had replicated in Virginia and Maryland. But gradually, the English inheritance was pared down to a few well-considered options. By the second half of the 17th century, 1- and 2-room hall and chamber dwellings with gable end chimneys became the most predominant form. Settlers completely rethought the arrangement of service rooms, consigning spaces such as the kitchen, pantry, and buttery to detached structures known as outhouses. Servants were moved out of the house into separate quarters, a process that was accelerated with the increasing importation of African slaves in the 1670s and 1680s. New service buildings, such as smokehouses, where butchered hog meat was left to dry, and washhouses first make their appearance in the Chesapeake landscape by the beginning of the 18th century. From this architectural experimentation emerged one of the fundamental characteristics of Southern architecture, a farmstead composed of a series of small domestic and agricultural service buildings dispersed around a modest dwelling house by English standards. If the horrid conditions of the early tobacco colonies illustrate the impediments to replication and the power of adaptation, the pull of inheritance can be seen in the transformation of American architecture in the late colonial period, when stable architectural societies flourished up and down the eastern seaboard. Historians often define the maturation of colonial society in the 18th century as a process of Anglicization, the replication of behaviors, customs, and fashions of contemporary English society. This process has also been described as refinement, and the architectural implications of such a process can be seen in every port town, merchant's house, and great planter's dwelling, with the goods, fittings, and social dynamics and ceremonies enacted by the aspiring class. The double pile, two-story, with house in Williamsburg has its counterparts in English provincial towns, where a similar genteel society sets store by the same goods, rituals, and social manners practiced by George Wythe and his family in the colonial capital in the third quarter of the 18th century. So this is a familiar pattern recognized by historians of provincial English culture who examine the interaction between regional traditions and metropolitan influences. Yet even though goods such as paint, wallpaper, stone, mantels, and hardware may have been British, fresh off the ship from Bristol, Liverpool, London, or Glasgow. This process of replication is grounded in the peculiar circumstances of colonial American culture, making it different from the standard study of metropolitan design precedents and the reception in provincial cities and remote corners of Britain. Recent historical scholarship has explored the interaction of component parts of the British imperial system. As Bernard Balin and Philip Morgan have suggested, instead of a single, coherent outward thrust by the English, the process should have been seen vastly more complicated, much more double-ended, with the colonies playing a dynamic role as the metropolitus. Although the movement of the ideas in the 17th and 18th centuries proceeded in the east-to-west direction, the transatlantic connection was imperfect, to say the least. Distance certainly weakened the communication of ideas and time-lagged them, and a few, if any, English or continental ideas existed in their complete and orthodox form in colonial North America. Enormous differences in the environment and social conditions, combined with the vigor of local practices to transform metropolitan areas into something identifiably American with at least five distinctive regional manifestations. New England, the Hudson Valley, the Delaware Valley, the Chesapeake, and the Carolina Lowcountry. At the heart of the study of early American architecture is the nature of regionalism, although we tend to characterize the buildings of this period in such a manner, there are epistemological issues with this organizational principle. Scholars have acknowledged the difficulty of defining the term or distinguishing the boundaries of various regions or their temporal dimensions. Exactly where does the Delaware Valley end and the Chesapeake begin? Why do these boundaries shift over time? How and when do diverse ethnically associated building forms blend to establish a new regional tradition? And in terms of transatlantic patterns, in what manner does a region respond to metropolitan or academic fashion? Are some regions more receptive to outside influences than others? To classify architecture along regional lines requires comparisons and accentuates contrast over communities. How do we set our standards of comparison, and against what do we measure them by? The national, metropolitan, or academic ideas? What makes the finished treatment of the Anglican Church built in Lancashire in the 1730s different from that in the church erected in Lancaster County, Virginia, at the same time frame? The answers to such questions often depend on the precision of the focus or the nature of categorization. All buildings erected in the late 17th and 18th centuries in these different areas shared many similar features, but they're recognizably different as an ensemble. What elements, therefore, must coalesce to create a regional form, plan, materials, and details, or parts of these? As noted earlier, the architecture of early America was overwhelmingly wooden. Yet even within the uniformity, building technology varied widely. The earth fast clapboard carpentry of Virginia House certainly set the Chesapeake apart from mainstream English timber framing and its identifiable cousin in New England. Architectural finishes, the small decorative elements, like European germs, seem to have traveled best across oceans and continents. At the micro level, colonial American builders devise no new details and fashion no new moldings, but used traditional forms that were intangible from their British counterparts. The first British settlers in America shaped their buildings with English tools so that the hollow and round shadow moldings in the earliest surviving structures formed the 17th century mirror English ones. Later, native-born craftsmen worked at the same classical vocabulary as their English cousins, using molding planes equipped with iron blades wrought in Sheffield or Birmingham. double architraves and cyma backbands, and half-inch beads appear in 18th-century buildings in Williamsburg as well as in Westminster, England. Raised panel wainscoting with overlow or cyma moldings are quite ubiquitous, covering the walls of taverns, dwellings, public buildings, and churches. Wherever these craftsmen worked, ogee-shaped bench legs can be found supporting jury boxes in the courtroom in the Shire Hall in Dorchester, Dorset, and pews in the Aquinia Church in Stafford County, Virginia. Fluted balusters decorate the stairs of Merchant Mile Breton's house in Charleston, South Carolina, and the pulpit stairs at Christ Church in Lancaster County, Virginia. Twisted balusters appear in the pulpit stairs of the Presbyterian Meeting House in St. Bury Edmunds, Suffolk, England, and the Sabbatarian Baptist Meeting House in Newport, Rhode Island. These were the universal building blocks of the Georgian designed vocabulary found across the Anglo-American world. They provide a reassuring measure of familiarity for those who seek the common architectural bonds that unite Great Britain with her American colonies. Up close, the architectural details are indistinguishable whether on the frontier or the heartland in the farmhouse or in a townhouse in a city. So step back and survey them in a room and the setting is recognizable, though they may be arranged in a different manner with a few new features. Perhaps they belong in a building in a neighboring county. Open a door and walk outside, and you are standing in a strange place, beyond the pale. The materials and the relationship of the various parts of the whole and to the site combined to define a distinctive regional or local setting. It's all a matter of your perspective and expectations. Somewhere in the middle distance, early American architecture can be recognized. Those who work in the field are constantly shifting their focal range, searching for the architectural grammar as well as the details that derive from the English heritage, but constantly readjusting their perspectives to see just how profound the local forces were in shaping the built environment. Greg Perry, the Historic Preservationist, signing off. Thanks for listening.